All right. Welcome to the ADA Audio Conference Series. This is the first series, the first session of 2015. The ADA Audio Conference Series is a project of the ADA National Network, which is funded by the U.S. Department of Education. Welcome to today's session, Accessible Construction Management. Our speaker today is someone that is familiar to the ADA National Network. She is a previous director of the Northeast ADA Center. She is a past presenter at the National ADA Symposium. She will be presenting at the 2015 National ADA Symposium upcoming in Atlanta, Georgia. She is currently the ADA coordinator for Cornell University. And you can find Andrea's full bio on the ADA Audio Conference webpage at www.ada-audio.org. Following Andrea's presentation, there will be an opportunity to engage Andrea in a question and answer session. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to today's speaker, Andrea Henley Mott.
Thank you, Peter, very much. I appreciate it. We're going to jump in and get started just to really try to facilitate a lot of the discussion and the topics of accessible construction management and sort of the perspectives that I'm giving. So the goals of for today is to really talk about accessible project management and from the perspective of beyond compliance. My role and my approach to accessibility on campus for the last 8 years, almost 9 years, I have been the ADA coordinator for facility services within Cornell University. And my responsibilities is I manage our barrier removal project on campus. I manage a budget as the general project management of the ADA program that is part of our overall compliance obligations under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But I work with project managers and construction managers on projects that are both small and large within the context of our barrier removal project. I also do extensive plan review for all projects that request a PAR. It's a project approval request form for projects that are $50,000 or over. But I also will talk about small projects and new construction versus renovation and large as well as small scale things in the overall approach to this. I will talk a little bit today about Cornell University and our the Cornell standards that we've established for accessibility and trying to sort of have that relate to the pretty diverse audience that we have today. That is representative of both architects and architectural firms, consultants, straight through advocacy organizations, as well as state and local governments and other post-secondary institutions that are really in the same boat that we're in when trying to sort of manage the whole approach to construction management and how we can really look towards improving our accessible construction management, and when we spend the limited dollars that we have, how do we do that in the most effective way for both projects that are within the realm of barrier removal, but also projects that really are not necessarily intended to be barrier removal, but do have impacts within that sort of realm. So we'll be discussing the issues and the next steps as we go forward today. So I've got a series of slides that we're going to that are really talking points to be able to do. I don't have any like large graphics. It's really an issue of discussion of the concepts and trying to understand how, and I'm going to talk about from our perspective on the implementation side for the last 8 to 9 years of things that we've done in terms of the building of our ADA program. and in terms of our barrier removal. We're really old. Entering the 2015 is 150 years of existence of the Cornell University, and we're on the side of a pretty big hill. So we have topography issues, we have old historic preservation issues, and sort of trying to balance that with all aspects of what we do within facility services. So within this, the accessibility considerations that through all phases of this construction process, every step of the way, so that we're not looking at how do we plan things and then step back and to say, okay, so you know it's being constructed, you know, of course it's going to be constructed exactly as we planned it, which never really happens. You know, what happens in that whole process? And I'm going to talk about active participation in this process by all stakeholders in a proactive and meaningful way. So what does that mean? Who are the stakeholders that you that are included? And obviously, it's having folks that understand code compliance. And you know, we are in New York State, so we will. I continually talk about the interaction of the Americans with Disabilities Act 2010 standards with our New York State Uniform Fire Protection and Building Code, and that's certainly an aspect of it. We interact with our code officials, but a lot of times we have a lot of code experts. And our consultants, as well as our project managers or construction managers, but it's that distinction between code compliance and ADA compliance, and they're not necessarily one and the same in all of the aspects of it. But all of the other stakeholders, for us it's our transportation folks and understanding what are we talking about with new construction or alterations and the impact on parking or other aspects of transportation, landscape. Partners, our university landscape architect, our university architect, and how we're balancing this with historic preservation or other aspects of construction impact, our planning office, advocacy organizations within our group. We work with student organizations as well as our student disability services office, and trying to understand how that sort of fits, as well as we have different owners. When we're talking about different schools and we're saying doing a project within our School of Architecture, Art and Planning, or our School of Arts and Sciences, those facilities, personnel, or the deans within that, to make sure that what we're looking to do from a construction perspective is something that we are not doing without their input as well as their partnership within that overall sense of where things are. So what does ADA compliant mean? And I think, you know, given the audience we have here, we have all, there's a lot of expertise of understanding that. But from my perspective and what we're talking about, it could mean a variety of things. Does it mean the minimum considerations of accessibility, minimum standards? It's compliant, we're good to go, we don't need to worry about anything else. But, or is it accessible, but accessibility was really considered at the 11th hour. It's an afterthought in the overall piece. It could be good accessibility, but not great. And what I mean by that is that, you know, it's there's a ramp that's there, and the ramp was designed to be 1 to 12 compliant. But there's a lot of area in that could have extended that ramp so that it is a much more gradual slope, maybe a 1 in 19 ramp or something that would flow and make for accessibility. Or they put automatic door operators, but the operators aren't necessarily in the right side of where it should be to be able to go to the top of the ramp, push the operator, and it allows you access into that. Or ADA compliance sometimes is great accessibility. It has elements of universal design, and I'm going to talk about the concept of universal design. I don't have that as a separate slide, but it's something that's universally accessible, and for a lot of those of us who have worked in the disability field for a number of years, it's universal design is just that. It's accessible beyond this aspect of compliance. It's universally available for folks with a variety of different types of disabilities, for people who are aging, for people who are youth in strollers or bicycles or those types of things. It's just readily available and accessible to folks in a variety of ways. So when I talk about ADA compliant, and then this is something that most recently we had a project that I was managing on campus that was creating an accessible route in a tricky area. And it was an exterior route. It involved a sidewalk and a roadway and parking that was adjacent. And through the years, this area had really degraded, and we were trying to figure out the best approach to be able to do that. And the particular consultant that I was working with, he's like, "Well, technically, I could get you. It would be compliant, and you know, we'd be covered." And I just hesitated for a second. I'm like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, you know, we'd be safe. We'd be okay. You know, and nobody would be able to complain that it wasn't compliant with the current standards." And as we got through the discussion, it was like, "Well, wait a minute. Is that the best accessibility? Is that something that it's like? Well, you know, technically it would be accessible." And that's where it was frustrating for me, because my, you know, the push that we're trying to do is the limited resources that we have. We don't want to do something that with a couple of years of asphalt degrading, that it's we're going to be back in the same place we were at with not great accessibility. Whereas if we use different a different approach, a different surfacing, asphalt versus concrete versus, you know, it would be really good accessibility. It would be universal and it would last. And that's the balance of this. It's like, what do we do to get by? What do we do to make it really good accessibility, and that something for me as a customer that lasts, that we don't have to go back and fix on an annual basis or semi-annual basis or even every 5 years? And that's the balance that I will be talking about with specifics and the projects that I'm both involved in or that I manage. So going on to the next slide, talking about new construction versus alterations. And for us on our campus, it's a process of review. We want to review every project and be able to be involved. And that could be something as minimum as the installation of a new water fountain and bottle fillers. It's very, very popular on our campus is to have new water fountains and bottle fillers. But as we, you know, for those of you who work with this, bottle fillers can be difficult in terms of the height approach. They also can be really difficult even with technically compliant water fountains themselves, drinking fountains. The cane detection might be difficult to be able to do. So that's one of the things that may not rise to the level of our project approval request for funding, which is, again, anything that has a project that's $50,000 or more. But it's something that I want to work with our shops, work with the folks that are installing this to make sure that we're doing it in a way that there is cane detection, that we're installing that bottle filler approach at the appropriate height to be able to do that, as well as understanding construction impacts. And this is something that, again, with plan review on a project approval request for funding, I receive every project approval request as a notice, as well as the looking at the language and that's within that. Now, every project approval request form has a section of ADA impacts. Some people fill it out, some people don't. And so when I can see that it is not filled out, then we're able to connect with our project managers or folks that are on campus that are initiating whatever the project is. Again, something that is small scale, maybe $75,000 or $150,000, straight through to the multiple million-dollar projects that have multiple steps and series with them, so that we can just talk about what the overall approach is, what their plan is for facilitating compliance, which is such a key way that with new construction and alterations, just to have people know that there's oversight of that and that they're thinking of that particular project. When we first initiated that process on this campus, there was a lot of pushback for people who said, well, it's a roofing project. We really don't have to worry about this. You know, accessibility, what? Tell me what ADA impacts there is for this roofing project. And it only took a number, you know, a couple of times of working with different project managers to have them say and understand that it's, well, wait a minute, it's a roofing project, but this particular plan is to block the accessible route that is the primary accessible route around this particular building. So what's your plan if you're going to block this? How do you get people around this particular area during the construction? What other construction impacts will there be, even if you're doing HVAC repair in this particular area, but that's the person's primary accessible route from between their office and, say, an accessible restroom? What's the plan? What's the process? So it really forces our consultants, as well as our project managers that are typically Cornell employees that are managing this whole process, to be able to have them see what is it that we're doing and what are the potential impacts. And so that whole, a lot of times they'll have on there just, we'll refer to the Cornell standards for accessibility, or we'll refer to in collaboration with our ADA coordinator for facility services to really facilitate that process and make sure that things are done in a way that's considering as much as we can, or as things come up, that they'll be able to respond effectively to that whole process. This is I noticed this on the after I submitted this particular PowerPoint through. This is actually a typo. It's pre-design. It's not pre-construction, but it's more of a pre-design. And understanding this all-important phase in the process of understanding, again, from a large scale as well as a small scale, the whole process of understanding where accessibility fits in the whole construction process is budgeting. Understanding what the planning and the scope is of a particular project, again, being it small scale or large scale. What are the permitting aspects of this, and what permitting and historic preservation impacts will there be? We have a project that we're dealing with on our campus with our Urist Library. It's one of our, it's the old original library that was on campus. And we're improving the accessible route in and out of this particular building. Before we even started, a lot of what we were looking to do was going to impact the exterior of one of the entrances. We went through our Ithaca Historic Landmarks, ILPC, Ithaca Landmarks and Preservation Committee. It really helped us to be able to say, okay, this is what we're considering. Before we even secured our consultant, we did a lot of preliminary work with them to say, this is what we're thinking about doing. These would be the impacts. Would this be okay? So that then we're not spending our consultant dollars on having them have to do that in the overall scope, so that we started the initial conversation, but also then we were able to engage the consultant in that process, so that then we spent a lot less time and energy trying to sort of re-examine where things are. At this pre-design phase, we look at environmental impact statements, which, again, a lot of times doesn't have anything to do with accessibility, but it could, and it's just making sure that accessibility as well as historic preservation and environmental impact are together, and that it is consideration that we don't forget either at this particular stage of the construction or the design process. And then finally, expectations. What are the expectations? Is this something that be it one of the projects that I may manage specifically, is the expectation that we will be able to make this perfect accessibility, full ADA compliance. What is it that we want to have our consultant do? What are the expectations for this process? And it's really important to get that all on the table at this stage. Next is site development. Again, there's many different perspectives as you know, what is the site? And this is a big deal on our campus, just given the topography issues and places that we're looking to do. We're in the process of putting up a new health center on the current site, so they will be occupied while during the construction process. And within that, you know, the accessibility and the topography really has some significant impacts. And so we're trying to make sure that we can have that particular site, especially given the fact that it's our health science center, operate in a very effective way during that construction process. And so, you know, looking at the environmental impacts at the same time through that site development process is really important. I think prior to my, you know, working in this role, they didn't really consider accessibility at that site development stage. And I think it's one of those things we spend a lot of time with our planning office really looking at these types of things through our start development guidelines, so that accessibility is a component of that discussion that then is handed over to a consultant. Other aspects of pre-design and with the projects that I can speak to specifically for our request for proposals, when we are looking for a design on a particular thing and making very, very clear what our expectations are on an RFP. What, you know, that we're looking at, this is something that's providing, improving our accessibility to this particular building, or this is the expectation is that this will meet the model of accessibility and, you know, go above and beyond compliance to look at all aspects and all elements of accessibility to provide that. It's really important with the selection of the design professional. There are certain design professions that really embrace accessibility and really look at it as a challenge to be able to say, okay, let's see what we can do to make this a model. There are others that may try to get you around it. You know, what do we need to do to get by? And sometimes in certain projects that's acceptable. Other times it's our approach that it's like, well, that's not really going to benefit us in the long run if we are just getting by with accessibility. Is that the best accessibility? Is that the best use of our limited financial resources to be able to do? And that sort of fits into the whole access expectations. And we're really clear in our contract language with design professionals to make sure that folks understand specifically that, you know, what aspects of a compliance that we're talking about, compliance with federal, state, those types of things, compliance with the Cornell University design guidelines, and making it very clear that if, you know, partners need to be engaged in this process, and we're going to talk about that a little bit as we do plan review. The first, the aspects of the design process is schematic design. And for those of you who don't deal with this on a daily basis, this is a little bit of a balance between those who are here today that are design professionals or do project management versus folks that work in the advocacy community. So bear with me a little bit so that we can make sure that everybody's on the same page. But schematic is the general scope and concept of a design. It's, you know, a lot of times it's our first step after pre-design of looking at the overall scope of what is happening with this process. It's got great implications for accessibility, and it's an ideal time to really try to look at the overall direction of what is the flow, you know, where is the accessible route. And when I do plan design, I'm looking at how does someone access, get into the building from parking or drop-off or other approaches, you know, areas of egress. Are they all accessible? What's the program? You know, for us, it's all about the academic programs and implications of that in terms of is it interior, exterior, both. Then it's the next step of access around and through the building, you know, access to the to offices, to general, you know, assembly space, to open spaces within that may be used from an academic environment or otherwise, and offices and those types of things, accessible routes through that. And then finally, you know, restrooms, spent a lot of time looking at accessible restrooms and implications for that. Fire egress, certainly. We look at other, every other aspect of it. And then for us, I spend a lot of time looking at schematic design plan review and providing those real specific comments. And then that's the opportunity to be able to provide a lot of questions as to where are we going and you know, how does a person access this area in this particular direction? Or in the event of a fire, is there, you know, what is the plan for egress in this particular point that's only accessible via stairs? You know, what are sort of the overall directions? And that's just a great opportunity for to have those types of discussions to at least raise those questions to the design professionals that are going through it. The next step is design development, and that's the solidification of the design. And this is where, you know, depending on the scale of the project, this is maybe where you get your opinion of probable cost. For some of our smaller scale projects, we do opinion of probable costs, at least the preliminary discussions within the schematic design. But design development is just really refining what we, you know, what are the reactions to the comments that we provided. And believe me, I've provided a lot of comments at a schematic or raised questions at schematic, and then I go back to the design development, and there may or may not be something that is even addressed. You know, it's something that it's given us an opportunity. We have the Cornell Tech Campus in New York City and Roosevelt Island that's pretty large scale types of things that we're looking to do within that, the first academic building that we have there. And so a lot of times they were able to at least understand the direction that we were going, and there were a couple of areas that I was like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't look like there's an accessible route to this particular area in schematic. And then in design development, you saw that they were able to say, no, that's not actually, we reprogrammed it because we couldn't provide an accessible route to this particular area without it being a significant modification of the approach. So that's the way it's really good to look at it and have a sense of which direction and, you know, what's the relationship for us to the program, to the academic program or to the other programs that are being considered within the design of the particular facility. And then finally, construction documents. And this is not the place to start reviewing accessibility. If you've gone to this stage, it's problematic for the person, you know, who's providing accessibility comments, because if you find something that's significant, then there could be significant costs going back to the design professional to really rework some of the considerations. And this has happened with a lot of folks that we're looking at something and it's like, well, wait a minute. If you put the door to the restroom in that particular area, we can't achieve latch side clearance. There's not 18 inches of the latch side clearance to allow for that. So if you only find that out at the construction document stage, then you have to go back and retool the overall approach, and it may have significant design costs associated with it. So that if you find that at a schematic or a design development stage, it can be a lot easier to modify as opposed to the next step of the construction document stage. It's really, I think, the final check on access considerations. And again, reviewing your comments from hopefully at the schematic as well as design development stage to be able to see what's changed or what's not changed. And it's like, well, wait a minute, I thought we were looking to provide that. And so depending on the scale of the projects that we do that have these large scale design document phases, we will balance them with discussions with the consultant, architecture firm, or our project management team to be able to talk about some of the areas as opposed to just providing them in a document that goes and you don't know where, you know, and we review. There is usually response time for different aspects of your comments so that you can at least see where they've reviewed, but that sometimes gets lost. So it's really important to, if you can have a face-to-face with your team to be able to talk about some of these issues, and then you can flesh them all out at the same time to be able to do that. But again, hopefully all of this is done well in advance of the construction document phase. The next couple of slides are just some things that are sort of within the checklist of things that I look at with the reviews that we do for our large and small scale projects that we do on campus is parking, bus, drop-off, looking at what the interior or exterior as well as the interior accessible path of travel is. Then doors, hardware, including automatic operators, signages, thresholds, reach ranges. We're doing a lot on wayfinding, certainly on we have a large scale project that's happening on campus that's not driven by accessibility, but we certainly have a lot of collaboration with folks that are managing that particular project. Floor surfacing is a big deal for us, as well as like thresholds. And we've just, even though, by way of example, even though a beveled threshold can be compliant, we're just finding that going to a flat threshold through, say, by way of example, in and out of a toilet facility is a better way to go because it doesn't, those marble thresholds, again, even when designed to be compliant, aren't meeting the needs of water retention potentially, as well as a lot of the folks that may be using wheelchairs on our campus have either a temporary condition that affects, or it may be a long time frame associated with it, but they may be new to that. We had to, a brand new constructed building within our School of Human Ecology had to remove a numerous amounts of marble thresholds in and out of their restroom facilities because we had a student who had, with a brand new injury, was not a long time wheelchair user, but who could not get in and out of the restrooms unassisted because of the compliant marble thresholds. So those are the things that we've taken into consideration and have incorporated as part of our the Cornell standards. Reception areas, dining, lecture areas, offices, and we have a lot of large scale projects that are really looking at the instruction and areas of associated with that. You know, how accessible is the large scale area that for a student, but also for an instructor who may have limited mobilities. We have a lot of older buildings and classroom spaces that there's no accessible route to the front. And so it's, those are the considerations of like, well, there are other ways that we can retool that instruction space to make it more accessible. Drinking fountains, cane detection, protruding objects, lighting, as well as elevators, toilet rooms, all elements of toilet rooms. In addition to one of the one of my responsibilities is to really review and survey our campus facilities for accessibility so that we have a sense of where how we need to institute our accessible barrier removal program. And a lot of times looking at toilet rooms, we spend a lot of time and energy understanding all elements, paper towel dispensers to toilet paper dispensers, and we're real specific with our plan review for our large scale projects, but also for our facility staff, our shops that are installing and doing repairs so that as we're doing these things, they're done in an accessible manner for smaller scale projects. Areas of rescue assistance, that's something that we spend a lot of time, even though code may not require an area of rescue assistance if our New York State Uniform Fire Protection and Building Code says that the if the building is sprinkled, it does not need an area of rescue assistance. But a lot of times we're balancing as to whether or not that actually is the right way to go. There have been other places that we create the areas of rescue assistance with the audio and emergency phones associated with that so that folks understand where we're going. And then other access elements. I mean, this is not an exhaustive list. We have a variety of other things that we look at. In the overall concept, one thing that we don't have in there is projects that we're spending an extensive amount of time looking at technology upgrades and accessible technology in classrooms. And assistive listening systems is a large project that we're dealing with on campus and making sure that we're doing due diligence with not only the installation of assistive listening system, but the proper maintenance of those systems to make sure that they are operational and compatible with some of our advanced technology and some of our real, you know, advanced smart rooms. Sometimes they don't, when we're using different technology, it's not always compatible with the assistive listening system. So we do a lot of checks to make sure that whole process is done effectively. I've talked about construction impacts. We've talked about path of travel, closures, and then occupancy during construction. Those are things that we talk about in an ongoing basis, but it sometimes requires extensive teachable moments, as I say, to our construction managers as well as our project managers in the planning process but also with the construction process, that we may run into some additional things that we're not aware of, or an exterior path of travel is planned through a particular area. But then during the construction process, they have to take an additional path. And, you know, so often people are like, oh, we'll just throw down some wood chips and that's our good accessible route. And it's like, no, that's not really going to work. We've got to come up with a better solution. And a lot of times this is on the fly. It's not something that we have extensive amounts of time to come up with things. And then there's been times that we spend additional resources to make sure that it's a true accessible route, creating not usually concrete walkways, but asphalt walkways in a way that then have to be removed post-project. But that's the type of planning and budgeting that we have to do to make sure that that whole process is done in a seamless way. And you know, for us, our big deal is our construction window. a lot of time that we spend on campus is trying to figure out ways to do construction that has as much limited impact while our students are not here. And so for us, it's waiting until after our reunion in June, which is usually the first weekend in June, and then having to rush to try to get everything done between that time frame after reunion, but before the students return at the end of August or mid-August in some respects for orientation purposes. So it's a really tight time frame that we have to try to get different projects done that may result in road closures or directing people around a particular area, as well as multiple projects that are happening on campus at the same time. This summer, there are certain things that we're looking to do that right now aren't going to hit our summer window that we're planning for 2016, just because there may be six projects that are happening in our ag quad to be able to do that. And so it's like, okay, we can't close down that walkway because it's the only walkway associated with that. So that's going to be pushed to a 2016 schedule. So those are the types of things with proper planning and proper impact or involvement of all of our stakeholders, including utilities. That was another stakeholder that I didn't mention earlier, or that we're included in the overall process. I want to talk a little bit about experiential equity. This is something that I've actually worked with a number of groups on campus and consultants in trying to understand what is our overall approach. And the concept is, are people with disabilities able to have the same experience as people without disabilities? You know, experiential equity. And I think the best example that I have for this is we have, as I had mentioned earlier, this is coming upon the 150th anniversary or a sesquicentennial. Activities are happening this spring and summer on our campus. And as part of it, we had a consultant come in last year and create a the Sesquicentennial Grove. And it's over, if anybody's familiar with our campus, it overlooks our large slope that goes down, and then you can see in the distance the Cuba Lake sort of shed. And that's really what, it's a beautiful spot, and they wanted to create a sort of a memorial grove in this particular area so that we could have it be similar to our statues that are on campus that are just more of a monument area. And so they were, you know, we started the whole process, and again, very early stage of site development as well as schematic designs, and they were talking about this particular area. And it, one section of it, a lot of the benches and different words, they were creating these different sayings that were part of this overall grove of benches and stone that were in the sloped area, were down sort of not accessible. They were down a series of steps. And I asked the question, I'm like, well, how is that going to be accessible? How do we, you know, what's the overall experience that we're looking to create? And I'm like, well, a person who has limited mobility can just look down on that. And I'm like, well, that's not equitable access. That's really something that, you know, is there a way that we can have that the primary function of what we're looking to do all at one level so that we're not necessarily having something, you know, because they were saying, well, you could sit up here and then you could just look down over that. But you can, in order to do that properly, the size of the lettering of the different sayings and statements that were being made that were being installed wouldn't have been accessible. You wouldn't have been able to see that. And so it was more of if this is a similar concept to universal design. But again, are we creating an experience that is similar to that for people with disabilities that is for people without disabilities? And how do we create that sort of concept? And we've used this in different areas, and lecture spaces and performance spaces on campus, and trying to understand, and this is something that we've really pushed the envelope a little bit with folks to be able to say, think about the experience. And if you're, you know, a design professional or a project manager, think about it from the perspective of a person with a disability. Is that the same experience? Is it a similar experience? Is it okay that it's not the same experience? And in some respects, it may be okay to have it not be the same exact experience, but is it equitable? And that's the overall concept. And it's certainly not something that has been received or embraced in every aspect of it, I can say. But it's a concept that really talks about the beyond compliance. Is this something that really we can be proud of? And that's one of the things when we're talking about our sesquicentennial growth. They were able to create an overall experience that happens to be accessible. We looked at it at one point between schematic and design development, and all of a sudden a step appeared in that process that wasn't there before. And so we were able to say, well, no, this step. And they're like, well, there's an accessible route to it. And I'm like, well, no, is there any way we can make that one level area that, again, it's you can have a person with a disability using crutches or a cane or a walker or a wheelchair sitting with their peers so that there's not like a different level of accessibility associated with that. And everything is all at one area, and it's something we can be proud of and promote and really look at the types of things that we've got. So the applications for experiential equity are wide, you know, they different things. It's certainly easier in new construction, maybe with existing construction. That may not be something that is easily done. You know, as many of you know, and this has been a concept of accessibility and with ADA compliance, and then well in advance of the existence of the ADA, we've looked at this. It's expensive to construct. It's expensive to design and to construct. And so making sure that things are done in an accessible manner is key. You know, and I know so many of us that work in this field, either directly or indirectly, or look back and say, it was a missed opportunity. We should have looked at, you know, when we redesigned this entrance. You know, yes, we had another accessible entrance into this building, but with a little bit of modification, this could have been an accessible entrance as well. Why didn't we think about it in that way? And again, you know, there may be a variety of factors. It just, there wasn't the cost associated that allowed us to be able to make those modifications, or maybe it just was something that was an oversight to be able to do. And again, looking at 25 years of existence of the ADA, I think this is the next step. It's more looking at how do we create similar experiences. Yes, there are complications, and it's not an easy way to be able to do that, but it's the whole concept of you taking universal design and personalizing it and understanding it from that first person perspective. I welcome any questions on that when it comes to the question and the answer time. We've only got about just a few minutes left here of the presentation. Value engineering. This is something that happens again when it's the whole overall concept where the accessibility is included, or there's different aspects of the design that are included, but through either the design process or in the midst of the construction process, things are value engineered out, meaning they're removed. Costs may be limited. We had this recently on a large scale project on campus where there was supposed to be a ramp installed in a particular area, and then all of a sudden the ramp just never appeared. And it's like, wow, where does the ramp go? And I was like, oh, we ran out of budget. You know, we didn't have money in the budget for that, or we thought someone else was covering that cost. So a lot of times things, what can be the first to go, and it may be accessibility. It shouldn't be, certainly. Anything related to a certificate of occupancy under the building code or something that's really required for accessibility. But it's when things are looking to be value engineered out, it may be we've had certain things on campus that it may have been which again, in this northeast environment, it's something that we've seen air conditioning go out of some practice facilities or different areas. And so there are some pitfalls to accessibility associated with that. It is an issue of code compliance versus universal design. You've got to look at it and see what are those areas as you're doing value engineering, you know, what are there any potential impacts for accessibility if things are eliminated? I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about allowances, but it's one of the things that we that I have ongoing discussions with all of the time with our with my construction managers on the projects that they're managing for me, as well as the project managers, is allowances. You know, when and this is, you know, when construction occurs, you know, things happen in the field that change, and then we just had a large scale ramp, concrete ramp installed. And so in the overall design process, we were looking at it and I said, you know, I'd like you to design so that it's not the minimum standard. Do not design for a 1 in 12 or an 8.33%. Design for a, you know, 7% ramp or something that's not. We had real estate to work with, meaning there was a lot of space around this particular area that could have, that was allowed us to really do a nice gradual ramp. Again, the ramp still would require handrails and other things, but let's look at that. But then in the midst of a pour, there are certain aspects of it that were right at 8.33%. A couple of areas of the ramp as a, you know, switchback that was involved that was closer to 7%, but then we went to 8.33%. And so it's all of those things that overall oversight and management of that overall process is key. This is something that we do within the construction process. For projects that are being constructed either with an outside contractor or as well with our own staff that do different renovations and maintenance projects on our campus. You know, when we created the Cornell design standards for accessibility, there's the standards within the 2010 ADA, you know, standards, accessible standards for design. And excuse me. So we picked absolutes so that when we are looking to be able to do it, there's certain ranges for the heights of grab bars, ranges for a center line of a toilet, ranges for many different elements within a toilet room. We picked absolutes so that they'd be able to, from a new construction perspective, it's a little bit more complicated with alterations depending on field conditions. But we're real specific so that we can, you know, look at where things are installed in the proper way so that we're hitting the Cornell standards, but also making sure that if they have to vary from those Cornell standards at all, that we're perfectly within both the New York State Building Code and the 2010 guidelines for accessibility. So that's the type of things we'll spend a lot of time in the field actually looking at where the hardware is being installed, where the toilet hardware to make sure that the carrier for a toilet is not going to be out of range, because there's nothing worse than spending all of that money on a brand new toilet and having it be 2 inches lower than what the standards allow for it. So we spend a lot of time with our contractors, with our design professionals, making sure that we're picky. And I say we're picky for a reason, because we don't want to spend any money of your time or our time going back, even though you know, all of our contract language says that we need to be perfectly compliant. When construction occurs, some strange things happen. So that takes us right to the end of the time that we have. There's a lot more I could certainly talk about, but I wanted to be able to get through the overall pieces that we're doing on our campus, and at least gave it from our perspective, from understanding and making this a real comprehensive process for construction management, to make sure that we are doing things correctly, so we're not spending double the time of design to be able to make things accessible in that design process. We're not spending money and resources to undo elements that are not accessible, don't meet the ADA standards or our New York State Building Code standards, and that are an overall process to improving accessibility. One thing I didn't talk about that I just want to mention, that it's another component of this. It sort of fits into construction management a little bit. We do also a review. It's called an event registration form review for all projects and activities that happen on campus, so that as people develop programs or activities, that you know, it could be our student, it could be a president's office, that they have to fill out this event registration form and talk about accessibility and how they're making that program, service, or activity accessible. So it sort of fits into the other components of it, but we also review that and talk about accessibility from a programmatic sense. So that's sort of one component that we do to try to ensure accessibility. Peter?
All right, thank you very much for all of that that great information. We're going to open it up to questions at this point for those of you in the webinar room. Again, you can click on the chat area to enter your questions and submit those, hit enter, or you can use the keystroke function control M, that will put focus in the chat area, submit your question. Even though you can't see your question once you've submitted it, it is viewable by the moderators and presenters. And Cherie, if you want to come on now and give the telephone participants instructions on how they can ask questions, please.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star then one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press star then one.
All right, Andrea, while we're waiting for questions to come in, to start with one, how important have you seen it, you know, at Cornell regarding the development of consistently applied policies? I just know from, you know, personal experience being at a large academic institution that there have been situations where, you know, disability organizations have you know, gotten certain things done regarding alterations or projects, but then staff changes, things change, and without, you know, consistent policies in place, you know, some things tend to, you know, fall through, you know, with future projects. How has that been addressed at Cornell in your experience?
You know, it's been something that for us, it's really when I was part of the ADA Technical Assistance Center at Cornell for 11 years before I came to the facility services side of Cornell, they had different approaches to accessibility, different ADA coordinators and folks that would do implementation. And then when I came here, we sort of reestablished sort of our approach for us, we created a three-part ADA coordination team. I deal with the facility services as well as the disability strategic planning component of it. But then we have someone obviously in student disability services that deals with academic accommodation and someone in human resources that deals with more of the employment accommodations to be able to do it. So we've established this disability strategic planning so that it, and it involves a variety of participation. With the six areas that we're looking to do are technology, employment, emergency planning, physical access, educational programs, and I think the final one was employment. I think I repeated myself, but this, so we're doing it so that it's not one person focused. We're really trying to look at more of the whole overall holistic approach to accessibility so that it's not something that falls through the cracks when one person happens to leave, and that we're able to create systems in place that allow for that. Does that answer your question?
Yes, actually, and just as a quick follow-up, did that that type of model that's in place, did that come out of having a quote-unquote champion within the administration, or was it done out of a, you know, the perspective of, you know, in, this is a legal obligation that, you know, to meet that, or was it a, you know, a combination of different factors?
I think that's a great question, because I think it's a combination, because it, for us, the fear of a lawsuit only gets you so far. You know, of a lawsuit, a 504 complaint, or a DOJ investigation. You know, a lot of some people are like, oh, you know, if we don't do this, we'll get sued. Well, that only gets you so far, and that only gives you the perspective of what do we need to do to get by, or looking at any consent decrees that we've seen from other types of groups. So Cornell, you know, we looked at what other peer institutions have done when they have had 504 complaints or private rights of action. But, and then we also thought about what fits in with our overall value system. You know, what is it that, you know, makes sense for us budget-wise to allow us to you know, allocate resources for barrier removal, but also, you know, beyond that aspect of it. So it has been a sort of a varying degree, but we do have a lot of champions associated with this. You know, we have an executive steering committee on disability that involves all of our senior administration and leadership, from the provost office, every vice president of the institution, you know, except for some, you know, that we have the provost office as well as other folks that are part of this, and they are part of our strategic planning perspective. So it is sort of multifaceted, and that it's not necessarily fear of a lawsuit, but we certainly watch how other people are faring when they're either sued or investigated.
All right, let me go to one more question submitted in the chat area before we check the telephone for questions. And this questioner wanted to know how you deal with the issue of, they indicate that they have a lot of outside installations by outside companies with regards to vending machines, displays, display racks, where those protrude into the accessible route, either, you know, limiting the, you know, the width of the accessible route, or becoming a protruding object for someone that's blind or has low vision, and how is that that particular aspect managed at Cornell?
Yeah, that is one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about, because protrusion into an accessible route is a big deal. And we have multiple training for folks to understand what we talk about with, in terms of cane detection. We have a lot of examples of where it's not done, been done well. And so it's just oversight. And again, protruding objects sometimes can be hard to see in a plan review perspective too. when we were looking at plain view, you can't necessarily always see where an object is going to be protruding greater than 4 inches, or things get installed overnight. All of a sudden, we've had televisions that have been installed in hallways that it's like, well, wait a minute, this, you know, certainly less than 80 inches. And from the finished floor, it's like, wait a minute, have you thought about that? So there's multiple means with which that we've tried to address it, as well as for us, it's eyewash stations in a lot of our laboratory areas. That's one other area we could spend the entire session talking about for post-secondary institutions, talking about laboratory access. And eyewash stations is one of them. A lot of times they're in the hallway, and they are protruding objects. And you know, with how do we create accessible routes upon them? So we've gotten pretty creative with trying to make them both accessible, you know, from a pole station perspective, from a seated position, but also making sure that they are not a cane detection barrier.
And let me get one more question that sort of ties into this. Another chat question. Someone wanted to know: do you conduct regular surveys of your existing facilities to monitor the accessibility of those areas?
Yes, we do. We have a large scale project on campus. It's called the Facilities Physical Needs Management System. Of course, it's got to have an acronym: FPNMS. And so the FPNMS is something that we have our primary buildings reviewed annually. And this allows us to understand some of the large-scale budget issues, but it's not just for accessibility. There's an accessibility component of it, which is great. That's the way that we want to do it. It's not like a separate but equal process. It's a process that, I mean, you look at air handling units from paint, windows, you know, all aspects of a building system, and accessibility is another component of it, so that we're able to capture our deficiencies and know from a budgeting perspective what are our large scale. Now, you know, there's certain buildings where door hardware is a significant issue that we deal with. Obviously, we don't go through a building and look at, okay, we're going to just switch out all the hardware in this particular facility, because that certainly doesn't make sense from a barrier removal perspective. But at least we have an understanding that, you know, where large-scale deficiencies are and how do we address the signage or the hardware in that particular area. It's another thing, too, from a maintenance perspective, as hardware is switched out, as signage is switched out, it's done in an accessible way. So that's a way that we also address some of our accessibility deficiencies that are indicated on our annual FPNMS review.
Okay, great. Cherie, do we have any questions on the telephone at this time, please?
Yes, we have our question from Matt Norris.
All right, go ahead, Matt.
Go ahead with your question.
Hi. As an interior designer, I'm concerned about aesthetics and comfort and sort of a feng shui perspective. I'm wondering, from the pre-design level to the development phase, what types of pushback do you receive from contractors and budget managers to offer aesthetics, more curvilinear ramps, and less linear and geometric accesses? Meaning, how much meandering are you able to add to the design without getting a pushback?
I think that's a perfect perspective to be able to, how much meandering? I'm going to use that in a discussion with a design professional. It just depends on the issue, and we spend a lot of time. We have a school of human ecology and a program within it called design and environmental analysis, and it's one of those things that we spend a lot of time looking at aesthetics and lighting and different in what the overall scheme is, and a lot of times that the working with our interior designers, we're sort of partners in that overall approach of understanding. It's like, okay, if this happens to be accessible, what are the aesthetics associated with that? And that's where, you know, there's always pushback if we ask for things that are well beyond the accessibility requirements. But that's where that balance between universal design and accessibility. It's not too often that the interior design and accessibility requirements clash, but it's more of how do they create symbiotic relationships in terms of things that happen to be good on the accessibility, you know, for lighting, say, for a person who has low vision. And whatever type of environment we're trying to create, say in a classroom or office space or general assembly space, those types of things.
All right.
So I guess the question is, the answer is it depends.
There you go. It's a quick question before I check the telephone again about allowances in terms of you know, talking about construction tolerances and what is too much, but I think that the more important part of the question, the participant's question is, you know, do you require, you know, the contractor to go back if the you know, if a ramp, you know, is outside of the, you know, allowable, you know, construction tolerances or outside of what was specified?
Yes. Yeah, we've had to do that. And we've actually had in different areas where we'll have a second or third party review of different ramps because it's like, wait a minute. And being a wheelchair user myself, I can get on it and usually tell if it's something that it's good or if it's out of compliance, just with the years that I've had in pushing up different ramps. And so we've just had to, and again, that's why the contract language is important to have there, you know. And again, was it something that was designed appropriately? A lot of times we'll have to go back and look at that, but also, you know, if it was designed, you know, is it something that falls within the construction tolerance area, or is it something that the contractor has to go back and do? We had that recently with a center line of the toilet, and the center line of the toilet was it's the range of 16 to 18 inches from the wall, and we were 18 and 13 30 seconds off. That's where it was. So it's 13 30 seconds out of compliance, and it's like, okay, we've got to make it accessible. It was something that was really one of our partners with the code enforcement office was pushing to be able to say, you know, we have 16 to 18. If it's off, it needs to be fixed, and the contractor had to fix it. Thankfully, they were able to fix it without a large-scale wall renovation, but if they weren't able to get to that range of 16 to 18 inches without any large-scale modification there, that's what they would have had to do.
You said, and that's standard language that's in your contracts with your contractors, whether it's the design professional or the vendor or the company that's actually installing the or making the alterations?
Yes. So it's in the contract language, but also we're making sure that it's, you know, that we're through review, that, you know, through the different phases of design review, that we're trying to catch certain things so that we're not, again, going, even though it says in the contract language that we need to provide accessibility, we're not waiting to the 11th hour to find out, oh, we didn't. So that's why it's sort of a multi-phase approach.
Great. Sheree, do we have another question on the telephone at this time?
Yes, we have a question from Pat Dillon.
Go ahead with your question.
This is actually Stan Brown with Pat's group with the St. Louis County Commission on Disabilities. Cornell there in Ithaca has obviously got a lot of historic building, probably landmark. What's your approach, or what have you been doing and trying to make some of those buildings ADA compliant and modifying those historic buildings out? How have you approached that, and what kind of problems have you faced?
That's a great question, because it is, you know, we are in a lot of areas that even, there's a couple of projects that we were working on with our Willard Strake Hall, which is our student union, and it's not on the National Registry of Historic Places, but obviously, even if it may or may not be, we don't want to do anything that will certainly threaten or destroy the historic integrity of the building. So it's a balance, and it's something that we do due diligence with and making sure. So a lot of times it's in looking at where's the primary elevation. Obviously, there's parts of our arts quad where some of the three original buildings on campus that we're not putting ramps in the front primary ornamental staircases to be able to do that. We've created, and actually some of that accessibility has been there for a number of years, whereas we were able to create accessibility that provides an accessible route to the facility, but doesn't necessarily affect the historic integrity of the space. So it's something that it's very much a partnership. We were looking at providing an accessible route to a large, general can I say here, a large residence that also had a dining facility in this. And one of our consultants said, well, you can just cut through this particular primary window facade, and which gave our, you know, gave certain people palpitations because they're like, no, you know, there's no way that we're going to cut through that window to create an accessible route via ramp to be able to do it. And so it's like, okay, even though a consultant that was specialized in historic preservation said that it would be fine, we were able to find another accessible route into this particular facility that really met the needs and also allowed for the creation of a good primary accessible route and a brand new toilet room space that would allow it to serve that particular function area. So it's a balance. It's not like we're saying, oh, okay, well, this is the only way. It's like, okay, this is not an option, and it would threaten or destroy the historic integrity of this particular place. You know, we look at multiple perspectives on that, but also trying to figure out what works best. And I think the key is the partnership with folks so that, again, and a lot of times in my experience, the solution is somewhere in the middle. It's not saying, okay, we can't touch the building because it's historically significant, or saying, you know, that you know, who cares about historic significance? We're gonna make it accessible in any way we can. It's trying to find that balance back and forth between the two. And a lot of times, I always say there's a solution. There's got to be a solution somewhere. And so the key is finding that and making it work.
And this question relates to some of the changes in the 2010 standards from the previous standards, the primary one being, you know, reach ranges going under the previous standards. You could have a 54 high reach for a side approach. Now for both the side and for a side and forward approach, maximum reach is 48 inches. And how are you at Cornell dealing with those? Obviously, there's safe harbor language in the standards and in the regulations that allow you to leave elements that comply with the 1991 standards. Are you leaving those elements until there's a planned alteration, or are you including those as you conduct your annual reviews of buildings and facilities?
It's a great question. A lot of times that we, you know, as we identify deficiencies, and I think the primary area that we see quite often is with toilet or paper towel dispensers. And a lot of them were installed so that the operable part was at 54. And so we just are noting that as we're renovating, as modifications are made, that those are being moved down to be able to do that. Making sure that, again, some of them that we've noted and that we've made modifications to were not even, would not fall into the safe harbor aspects of it because they might have been at 55 or 60, you know, which is, again, not accessible for anybody, really. And so we make those modifications initially, you know, as soon as those deficiencies are noted. But as we do that, and new design and construction, obviously, I'm real much a stickler as to those elements because those aren't always on an elevation plan, or they'll pull up, you know, the 2010 standards, and they'll just cut and paste on a plan, and just be able to say, okay, we're going to comply with all of these things. And so then we will bring in our Cornell standards and say to the design professional, make sure that these are included to be able to do that. But also making sure that that balance between the design and the construction, because soap dispensers, I mean, all of those picky little things are a huge issue, and a lot of times are not really followed as tightly as they need to be. So we do a balance of both. We make modifications as we see fit, but we do note if deficiencies are there for that retrained.
And that's an excellent point that you make about existing. Just because something is existing doesn't mean it falls under safe harbor, because you may have something that's mounted above 54 inches, so it's not, doesn't even fall under the safe harbor. So that's an excellent point that they have to, that folks need to be aware of that. Sheree, do we have another question on the telephone as we are getting closer to the bottom of the hour here?
We do have a follow-up question from Matt Norris's line.
All right, go ahead.
Hello. I have a question that deals with the design impact. With the Wounded Warriors being more apparent and the government supporting that, wheelchair accessibility has routinely been rear entry. In other words, you stand and pivot. But more and more engineers are coming up with front entry wheelchairs that have a folding flexibility to them, somewhat like a Segway, and you strap yourself in so it's much easier just to front load from the bed or a chair or from the toilets. Will that impact design, and have you considered that? The second question I have is for low vision clients. Do you have any concrete research that supports environmental conservation and using of natural lights, LED lights, whatever, and the cost of retrofitting all of the fixtures on campus?
Wow, and we only have 5 minutes left, or 4 minutes left, Peter. I don't know if I can catch all of that, but
right.
Let me try.
Address
me try.
If you can.
Yes. With regards to, you know, it's the whole question of I think it's more of a universal design and the change of structure in wheelchairs. We have a researcher on campus. His name is David Feathers, and he does a lot of universal design discussion and biometrics of really understanding wheeled mobility and the impact. That, you know, we certainly talked, I talked to his class, and we pulled him in on a lot of our discussions in the overall sense, but that's not something that I deal with on a day-to-day basis. I think that would be a question for future revisions of maybe IBC or when ANSI, you know, 2016-17 comes out, just to be able to talk about how that element of wheeled mobility as well as other types of devices will impact design to be able to do that. Because I have to say, as a wheelchair user, a lot of the ways that people show people transfer, say, to a bed or to a toilet, it doesn't always mean that that's the way that everybody always transfers. I think people do it in a variety of ways, of whatever way it works for them. And then the second question about lighting. I think that is an area of significant concern. I know that we make, and again, this is sort of the accommodations model that we're trying to move beyond within our university setting, so that we're not providing accommodations, but rather that universal design modality, so that we're designing things that happen to be accessible. And lighting is one large component of that. And we spend a lot of time for our exterior lighting as well as interior lighting discussions. And right now it's more at the accommodations model. And I'd like to see it go well beyond that, so that we're looking to include, and again, I'm not an area, that's not my area of expertise in terms of the lighting component and making sure that things are done in a way that accommodates folks with a variety of disabilities. But I just know that it's an area that needs a lot more research, at least in my opinion, from the implementation perspective that I can bring.
All right, let me get the one last question here before we hit the bottom of the hour. You talked about wayfinding, and I was just curious, is there a mechanism you have in place to update, you know, the folks at Cornell that are doing the online maps or the apps that allow people to identify accessible entrances, accessible parking when you're doing alterations, or when a construction project is upcoming, to notify the users out there that there are going to be interruptions in their normal routes?
Right. And it's one of those areas that we have spent a lot of time and resources, and we have a GIS specialist that works with us on updating our mapping on campus, but it needs to be updated significantly, and it needs to be a lot more dynamic and to accommodate the mobile applications, but also to be the model of accessibility for folks who use elements of assistive technology. And I think it's one of those things that I think we are looking and with the wayfinding project that we're doing to make it a lot more dynamic, so that it's not one-dimensional.
All right. Well, we have reached the bottom of the hour, and I apologize to those of you that didn't have an opportunity to have your question addressed. We just had lots of questions, just a fantastic topic and great presentation and information from Andrea, and want to thank her profusely on behalf of the ADA National Network for giving us her time and expertise on this topic. As a reminder, the session is being recorded, and the audio archive will be made available within 24 hours at the ADA audio homepage, and an edited transcript will be available on the webpage within several weeks. And that's www.ada-audio.org. Again, the audio conference is a project of the ADA National Network. You can contact your regional ADA center. So if you have any follow-up questions that come about as a result of today's topic, you can contact your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232. As a reminder, our next session in the ADA Audio Conference series will take place on February the 17th, and the topic for that session will be reasonable accommodations in the workplace for deaf and hard of hearing employees. You can find information and registration information for that upcoming session by visiting www.ada-audio.org. If you have questions, you can contact the Great Lakes ADA Center at 877-232-1990. Again, on behalf of the ADA National Network, I want to thank Andrea, and I want to thank all of you for participating today. We look forward to having you participate in future ADA audio conference sessions. This will conclude our sessions. Those of you in the webinar room can close your webinar browser. Thank you, and have a good day.